Boston area. So I'm proud to introduce Carol to you, and I'm delighted that you're here.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Linda. Sorry I'm late. A lot of people coming here today, apparently. My name is Carol Copeland. I work for Mass Peace Action, as she said, and I'll talk a little bit about the work that we do. I've been working with them for going on 9 years and volunteered with them before that. I see a few people out here who are familiar with Mass Peace Action. I want to start with some good news. The House of Representatives has approved some positive legislation aimed at reducing war. They voted after 18 years, finally, to cancel the 2001 AUMF, and that's thanks to Barbara Lee's tireless efforts. So maybe the revenge war on Afghanistan and Iran could come to a close. Now the Senate would have to agree for it to become a law. The House passed an amendment by Representative Omar requiring a report on financial costs and national security benefits for overseas military operations, including permanent military installations and bases. This sounds a little bit like asking for an audit of the Pentagon. It's not the whole thing, but it's very exciting, and we'll see how far that gets. But it did pass in the House to audit this portion of the military budget. And the Senate and House passed a bill to halt the Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen. This was unprecedented, I believe, that they both agreed to try to stop this war in Yemen. And, of course, we know what the president vetoed it, but at least it was a little step forward for the House and the Senate. We here can probably agree that the war is useless for resolving conflicts, but what do we spend on war? Our current federal budget consists of three categories: mandatory, discretionary, and a portion of it for interest on the debt. About two-thirds of our budget is for mandatory spending, things like Social Security, unemployment, Medicare. A bit less than a third is on the discretionary budget, and the interest on the debt is only about 6%. The discretionary budget allocates money for veterans, benefits, education, housing, energy, and transportation, and the military. More than half of this discretionary budget is spent on the military, and most of us think it is too much. Right now, it is about $750 billion. Do we really need a military and defense that costs $750 billion? I think we know the answer to that. And who are our enemies except the people that we've invaded, perhaps? There has been a notion by some that war is good for the economy, but studies have shown that similar investments in non-defense industries create many more jobs, healthcare, and infrastructure, and also certainly better outcomes. What we spend on war and war preparation is a key issue if we want to invest in important needs like the environment and poverty reduction. We spend $750 billion while people go hungry and have no place to sleep at night. It has been said that the money we spend on the military could eliminate poverty in the world. I'll just go over these numbers one more time, just so you get them in your mind. Our entire federal budget is $4 trillion. Two-thirds of that goes to mandatory Social Security, paying salaries, subsidizing education, healthcare. The other is spent on discretionary things like education, housing, science, education, and the military. So we've decided by vote of Congress to spend half of that discretionary money on the military. I think we need to speak up and tell our Congress people we don't favor that kind of expenditure. A lot of screw up at a time I did when we were constantly at war. There was Vietnam and Central America and Afghanistan, Iraq and Syria. And I think times have changed, maybe for the better. Could it be we are evolving? I like to be hopeful. The enemies of peace are people who believe that strength is power, that war is inevitable, and especially those who profit from war. The corporate media likes war because it sells papers. So how do we make peace a winning issue? Part of our job, and we do this at Mass Peace Action, is trying to educate ourselves and the public. And now that the election season is upon us, we will spend some of our time advocating for candidates who will continue to promote and vote for legislation and policies that end war and improve the well-being of everyone. When you look at the candidates for president, you'll see that several of them are talking about reducing the Pentagon budget, withdrawing from Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. It is heartening to see that. It's been a while. Incumbents are being challenged by a new generation of citizens eager to turn away from the old days. And kudos to the Green Party for making peace and nonviolence a key part of its platform. It should be the basis for all of our work. These ideas are unusual in my lifetime, and I hope the trend continues. I believe our advocacy for peace has had an effect, and I thank all of you for the work you do to make and enrich our lives.
Thank you, Carol, so much. I'm going to introduce myself because I was chairing. And I'm standing because I don't want to be in back of this whole thing. But anyway, I moved to Boston in 1960, and I joined the anti-war movement and became president of the Cambridge Anti-War Committee. Was one of the first anti-war committees in the city of Boston. And then moved on from that to become coordinator of the Greater Boston Coordinating Committee to End the War in Vietnam. It included about 45 organizations at the time because every single campus had an anti-war committee. It was massive. And then we joined with the Moratorium Committee in Boston, which was the more conservative forces. But we unified. Everything in that time when there's an upsurge of the move is to unify. And we had over 100,000 people on the Boston Common. The march started on the Cambridge Common and marched all the way down Mass Avenue to the Boston Common. You couldn't see the end in sight. That's what those days were like. We are not in that period, obviously. So we have a number of challenges ahead of us. What to do about it? There's no more draft. Students are working three jobs. Families are working three jobs. They don't have the free time that we used to have. Rents are higher. All the anti-war activists I know were paying cheap rent and doing a lot of full-time anti-war work. And that's all gone. So we're facing those physical problems. But the main thing is this hidden empire of the military. It's actually 62 cents of every dollar goes to the military when you count all the appropriations that are under the board and that they just do whenever they feel they need it. So they use that money to get their tentacles into every single aspect of our lives and our personal lives. They control the educational system by giving grants to campuses like MIT. MIT could not do what it's doing without that research money that they get from the government. Every single campus, you go just through them, there's a list. And I want to point to a book called How the Military Invades Our Lives, The Complex by Nick Turse. Read it. Because it paints a picture of this octopus with these tentacles into every single area, from entertainment to the media to the educational system. And what used to be called the military-industrial complex is now the military-technological complex, and the educational complex, and the research complex. The scientific complex, the homeland security complex, national security, they're all connected by this monolithic thing that takes half our money to spend to kill people. That's what it's all about. Control, domination, and killing. And they're coming up with more and more horrible weapons of mass destruction all the time. A lot of our money is going for that research. So I think a lot of us know that, but Nick Turse's book gives you the picture that most Americans simply do not have of how overwhelming this control is when they go to NASCAR and they have their little sporting events and so on. So we have to draw that picture for the American people because they can't even begin to talk about it if they can't see it. And a lot of it is like an invisible empire. So that's up to us, and I think that book really helps. Now, what I'd like to do is get to all the speakers spoke about the challenges that we're facing as a very weak anti-war movement right now. I said, one, get the facts out. Two is I believe we need a national conference to invite all the different coalitions. The anti-war movement is divided into Peace Action, into UNAC, United National Anti-War Coalition. Then there's the Answer Coalition, and all these different groups are not working together. In the 60s, we forced people to work together. If we had to blackmail them, almost. And I'm not joking. You have to do that because people are all in their little worlds and their little sectarian things. And we shouldn't make a criteria of what is the politics of that. If we can agree on stop endless war, then everybody can bring all their little points of view into that one overwhelming thought that we want to convey to the American people. Have you read it in 1984 recently? Mm-hmm. Reread it. Three spheres of influence, Oceania, Eurasia, East Asia. Three spheres of influence that fight continually, endless war, and everybody knows they can't win, but they do it anyway to keep the proles in place. I reread this stuff and I said, wow. So anyway, I think unity is key. It's what I've fought for all my life. It's the only way we're effective. We have to break down these divisions. National conference would be helpful. And the other thing is there are three burgeoning movements that we're aware of. The immigration issue, Black Lives Matter, the Me Too movement, and the environmental movement. Now, they aren't coming to us. So we have to go to them. Just think of the September planetary events that are going to take place. We have to go with the anti-war message that the military is the most polluting entity on the earth. Huge use of fossil fuels. They have no plans to get off them. They are taking us on the road to destruction. So if we intervene, we can go to their meetings, we can go with material, we can go with contingents. If there's a big immigration march or a protest demonstration or whatever, we be there with our signs and banners. We've got to go to them, folks. It's not happening the other way this time around. So that's a suggestion I have. I'd like to introduce Margaret Flowers. If you could stand, Margaret, as one of our courageous Green Party members who took over the embassy. You didn't take it over, you were handed the embassy to defend, and they did a wonderful job. And right now, we're so proud of the Green Party leading that action. And we have to think of the Green Party as leaders of the anti-war movement, because Ajama was playing that role, Black Alliance for Peace. So many of us are active. And it's up to us, because the Democrats are pro-war and they won't let you talk about it. So our campaigns, we are the only anti-war party. We're the only ones that are going to confront them, and we have to take the lead. So we have material here on the embassy defense. We have our comrades are currently under attack. We'll have to talk about that. Maybe you could add something, Margaret. And I see a speaker over here that would like to say something. Sherry Hunkela.
You had asked me to make sure I interjected this, so I'm going to. just real briefly. I appreciate the whole panel. I would just like to say a way to bring everybody together around more than just a conference is opening day of the Democratic National Convention. We are not just leading a massive march July 13th in Milwaukee, but we're going. Poor People's Army is coming for its 62 cents. And we're coming for our 62 cents, and so I'm hoping that you'll be there with us as we claim that 62 cents, because you know, a little bit of it was talked about on the panel, but more people have died now as a result of the opiate crisis than during the Vietnam War. I live at ground zero for the country in terms of the amount of deaths. Now I'm chronicling, every morning I get up and I photograph somebody dying, being taken in an ambulance, and every night before I go to bed, I take a photograph of the ambulance. So, and our children walk back and forth every day. So the impact of post-traumatic stress disorder, and that this is a way to live life. And so war is war is war. I would just also say that, I mean, we just really, as all of these wonderful speakers do, have to lift up these two things simultaneously. And you know, I would also say, like, you know, that's why you'll also find the Poor People's Army in the leadership in the forefront, as well with Extinction Rebellion, because we understand that, you know, the other big wars are around things like being able to, like, have water and breathe and exist. So, and then my question is there an online petition yet for the Venezuelan protectors? And how can we make sure that thing, you know, goes viral?
We are putting one together. Actually, we do have it ready. It could go online, but one thing we are waiting for is the email address for the prosecutor and some important key elements in the Department of Justice. It's not easy to find them. That is why we're looking for it, but the petition is ready to go online as soon as we have some information about the contact, because we want their offices flooded with that petition.
Okay, Margaret.
And in the meantime, though, as you have on see on the flyer, we want you to go to the website. The first phase of this defense is to demand that they drop the charges. But as we are making that demand, we also have to prepare the defense, and because the government has committed itself to try to make examples of the defenders, they're trying to put them in jail, basically. And so it's going to be costly to have a representation that's going to be effective. So we have to raise resources. We need to raise $50,000 over the next 3 weeks. We only have about 12,000 so far. So we're asking people to circulate information on this, circulate information, asking people to support and donate and help us reach that goal.
What if
it's
an electronic form that you can spread it easily?
It's on the website. You can circulate the site, the link, right?
Yes, we're going to set it up. This was prepared yesterday for this meeting, actually.
Okay. You can send people to the website
already.
We
will set it up so that it will be online for download if you want to.
Yes.
Margaret, did you want to add anything?
Which website?
The website defendembassyprotectors.org.
Oh, here.
We're going to pass. How many do you have?
About 100. Right?
Okay, he has a flyer for everyone with the information. Okay?
And there's some extra here.
I'd like to encourage everybody. I'm going to take a stack after Margaret and everybody keep their remarks to like 2 minutes so we can get a lot of people.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank Mom and John for spearheading the Defense Committee, and all of the Greens who participated came down to the embassy, particularly also the Poor People's Army that came down numerous times to try to get food to us and had to put up with these very violent, racist, you know, pro-coup people who were assaulting our folks outside. I don't want to comment on that other than to say that a big part of this defense committee is to keep the fight going. We don't want this to turn inward and be about us. I mean, we knew the risk that we were taking, and if we have to serve some jail time, we'll serve some jail time. But we have to keep the fight up against the economic measures that the U.S. is using against the Venezuelans, which are killing tens of thousands of Venezuelans, and the ongoing attempts to overthrow the Maduro government. So the part of the defense committee is to keep that struggle going, and I think that really going to elevate that piece of it. But Linda, you brought up a really important point about unifying the peace movement. And over the past few years, we've been working to unify the peace movement, and I was wondering if perhaps John could comment on the upcoming people's mobilization to stop the U.S. war machine and save the planet, which is focused on making that connection between U.S. militarism and the climate crisis, as well as the lawlessness of the United States, disregard for international law in so many ways, and we'll be elevating that as well.
Okay, Bob and Juan to respond.
I just wanted to add another dimension to what Margaret said. It's not just a fundraising campaign. This committee is not just that. It is also a political campaign and a legal campaign. So this is the whole legal case of the United States government against these people is turning the international law upside down.
Yeah.
They were the protectors. The U.S. government, which had no authority, legitimacy to enter that premise, entered it illegally against international law.
Yes.
Now they are charging these people with interfering with the protective functions of the state, as if they are the occupiers and the government is trying to protect it, which was the opposite, actually. So in a sense, this campaign is also about exposing this big lie, that this, it helps the legal case also, because we have to show that the government is at fault with this, not those people. And that requires a good amount of propaganda on the part of all of us to convince people that this is a story. You have to explain and let them know that the government is just playing a trick on this one, and we have to expose that. As a result, I'm asking you to please, if you find any good article, can you write a good article about this case? Please send it to our email address on the flyer, and we will post it on the website. And we want to really continue with the political side of this story too, as Margaret emphasized, because that's a key to the success of legal case. So that's what.
Could we pass a hat? Yeah. Is that legal to do that? Could we pass
yes.
a hat?
Yes.
Well, has anybody got a hat?
Yes. Can we use your hat?
Can we have your hat for a minute?
This hat here.
Okay. Just get it going around. Give one you can.
I'm wearing a church basket.
Hey, we have a hat over here.
You got a good hat.
You got a hat going too?
Got a
oh, that's
hat.
A good hat. Okay.
Deep one.
That's a better hat. But you can go ahead. Okay, let's keep going here. I'm going to take a stack. Okay, I'll go from left to right. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. We'll start there, okay? So 2 minutes, if you could.
No problem. It has been noted that the volunteer draft that we have in this country is largely what has numbed the peace movement since Vietnam. And it has also been noted that that volunteer army would not be working without the extreme inequality in this country. A number of people, including myself, think this is not a coincidence. If we can locate a smoking gun to prove that assertion, we can do, I think, at the national level of this country, what we saw happen in Puerto Rico quite recently. Thoughts about this would be of interest to me.
Okay, next.
So we're going to take all the questions and
yes.
It'll be
interesting. Yeah.
Okay. When I ran for US Senate last year as a Green, I was challenging one of the biggest warmongers on the Democratic Party side, Senator Bob Menendez. And I was told by people who were concerned that Republicans not win that seat or other seats, that war, why was I focusing on war as an issue? Because it was a distraction. The issue of war is a distraction. And what drew me to this workshop was the title, that war is the issue. and I'd like to hear a little bit more from the panel about how to make war the issue and stand up to Democrats, so-called progressive Democrats, who think that war is a these issues are a distraction. I know why they think it's a distraction, because both parties agree. But I need more, we need more ammunition or arguments, not ammunition. We need more arguments to counter that. Thanks.
I think there's another hat.
Yeah, there's
one. Okay, I guess we're done.
Two hats are better than one.
There was two hats.
There are.
Okay, next is
I just wanted to do a focus, kind of, because I think war is not actually the central issue. It's money that finances war, and we have a war economy. And that is why we have wars. It's based on the money in this country, is based on the economy. So, of course, my answer and why I'm in the Green Party is because the Green Party is a divestment from the war economy. We do not take corporate money. We want a peace economy. So I try to tell people that. We need to educate people that the Green Party is more than just a political party. We're a divestment from the duopoly, and we need to end the two-party system. We're not going to end war until we do that. And we need to elect me. And we give people hope. It gives me hope to be in the Green Party because of the 3.5% rule. People believe that there needs a mass of movement of people to change the system, and it does not. It takes 3.5% to change this entire system. So people need hope, and they need to understand that money is the problem. And we need to connect the pipeline, environmental people, to the war movement, because there is no separation. Pipelines are war. We're here in it for war and empire, oil and empire. That's why we're in these wars, for control of that. So we're not going to get the connection through the big green and the NGO industrial complex. They're not coming to us because they are bought by the Democratic Party and the establishment, the people that run these big green and NGO industrial complex. We've got to go to the grassroots people and lead them at the grassroots.
Okay, you're next.
Do you have the bill numbers on those three bills? I'm always suspicious of Democratic form.
I probably do not.
You had the overseas budget again and the AUMF. I could get them later.
Yeah, I did not write them down.
Okay.
Wrong kind of green. If you guys have not gone to the website Wrong Kind of Green, it will expose the money behind all of this NGO industrial complex and the big green movement. And this is why we cannot get justice. And they're funneling us. They're funneling us into a controlled movement that does not really affect the establishment. Wrong.
Okay. Maha. Okay.
I had two questions. Well, one question, and two, I was going to say something similar to what you were saying, is that when we talk about endless war, I found something to be very powerful when you say $1 going to the military, so the dollar that goes to the military, each job created by the military, the same amount of money could create three jobs in the education sector. That is a showstopper.
Yeah.
People can grab that and identify with it. Moms, dads, children, everybody can, when they hear that statistic, it changes the debate whether you're talking about empire or this. Sometimes it's just a way to talk about or changing their idea about the military industrial complex without bringing Trump into the issue. It brings the military industrial complex down into their home community, education. My question was, what was the name of that book?
Okay.
How the military.
It's called The Complex.
The Complex.
How the Military Invades Our Everyday Life. And the author is Nick Tursey, T-U-R-S-E. Incredible book. Okay, who was next?
Just so everybody is aware, the Peace Action Committee has submitted to the National Committee a proposal that the Green Party USC support the September action. Okay? And just so everybody knows, tell your national delegates to vote for the proposal.
Okay, thank you. You next?
Yeah, my name is David Rold. I'm from here in Massachusetts. I have three very quick announcements. So the Green Party Presidential Candidates Forum is tonight at 6:30 downstairs in the recital hall. I'm running for president, and I'm calling to totally eliminate the U.S. military weapons industry, and I know all the other Green Party candidates are calling for, like, very drastic reductions in the U.S. military budget. So that's one announcement. And then Sunday night, this Sunday night, 2 days from now, Margaret and Kevin Zeese are going to be speaking about Venezuela at the Unitarian Church in Harvard Square in Cambridge, the one right in the middle of the square at 6 p.m., I think. And when I talked to them, they didn't know that a genre that you were going to be in town, so I'm sure if you wanted to come speak, we would love to have you too. I'll talk to you later. I'm in touch with the organizers. I can arrange that. I'm sorry I don't have flyers. I will try to have flyers tomorrow. And then the third announcement is that I'm working with Cindy Sheehan on the steering committee of Rage Against the War Machine, which is going to be an anti-war demo at the White House and marching in D.C. on Friday, October 11th, and then a conference called the Revolutionary Anti-Imperialist Summit on the next day, Saturday, October 12th. That's like Indigenous Peoples Day weekend, the weekend where we protest against Columbus Day. And so if people mark their calendars to come to D.C., and if any of the activists here want to get involved or speak at the rally or conference, you can contact me. And I'd also like to know how to get the Green Party Peace Action Committee to endorse that.
Okay, thank you. And I believe you are the next speaker.
Yeah, I have a question. So lots of Greens are involved in the anti-war movement. How do we make it so that Greens are at the same anti-war event? And like, this is partially a problem with the anti-war movement in general, right? Like the marches on Washington one weekend after another. But it's also a problem where Greens are involved in anti-war stuff, but like us in Pennsylvania haven't been hearing about it, even though we would like to know about it and we would like to participate. You know, other than like through public means where everyone is hearing about it. So I guess like, how can we as an organization put the full force of our organization into this movement, showing up at the same events? And that resolution is part of it, but I'm afraid that we're gonna pass a resolution and no one's gonna show up, right? Like, how do we turn that resolution into action?
Okay. Would some of the speakers like to respond to some of the discussion at this point?
Yep.
I'd like to have that happen, and we'll take a few more questions after.
First, let me just ask a very simple question. How many people in this room are opposed to war and militarism? Raise your hand. How many people in the room are members of one of the national anti-war organizations or coalitions? Very good. We have to connect the desire to be opposed to war and militarism with the issue of organization. One way in which we have to elevate the anti-war movement is to, in fact, strengthen the organizations. There's already been a quite eloquent analysis that says that there's a need for more coordinated activity in this country, and we're moving toward that. One of the events that Linda will be bringing together some of those same organizations you referenced, ANSWER, UNAC, all of them, is around September 20th to 23rd. That is the weekend of international peace. International Peace Day is September 21st. And so we have a coalition in place that's organizing activities to highlight that weekend. That's part of the process of trying to establish trust among these organizations, the alliances, coalitions, to revitalize this anti-war movement. And it's connected to, you know, the analysis of why is the movement so weak? I think the draft issue is an important issue. We know that basically you have one segment of the population that is fighting all of these endless wars when they do commit U.S. troops, and that is the working class and poor. If there were more folks from the petty bourgeois or the middle class involved in these activities, there might be more opposition to these endless wars, but they are not involved. The solution isn't bringing back the draft, but the solution, maybe that might help though, but the, I was opposed to when they eliminated myself. I was in the military. But the solution has to be to elevate people's awareness of the objective interests involved in these wars. That basically the people's interests are different from the interests of the oligarchy. But the oligarchy will attempt to try to suggest that the national interests are in fact their interests. We've got to make that break. We've got to sever that kind of connection in the consciousness of people in this country. And that's why it's so easy for them to mobilize support for interventions. The issue isn't just money. Money, of course, is a consequence. People make money, particularly the military-industrial complex. But in fact, the issue, or one of the major issues, in my estimation, is in fact the issue of war, militarism, and repression, and the ability of the state to be able to mobilize support for it. Why? Because it plays on notions of people's fear, a sense of security, a sense that there are these enemies out there that the U.S. has to be prepared to defend itself against. This struggle for consciousness is part of the struggle we have to engage in building this anti-war movement. In the Black Alliance for Peace, we're concerned about the issue of war, militarism, and imperialism, but we connect that up with the war we say is being waged against people, poor people, black people, working class people here in this country. That basically they're interconnected. And so we say that we are at war, and that basically we've got to, it was a one-sided war. We say that basically we have to organize ourselves, educate people, and so people understand that our interests are the interests of the working class and those of us who are committed to peace and social justice. Lastly, real quick, I would love to say we have an issue with too many marchers. We just don't have it. Basically, part of the consequence of the, I would say demoralization, but part of the consequence of the anti-war movement being so weak is that we are kind of running out of energy a little bit. Some people might be a little exhausted. Yep. So we should be, in fact, marching every week, especially in light of what may be happening with Iran, what they're trying to do with Venezuela. But we aren't. And part of what we have to do is to try to re-energize the anti-war movement. And part of that is, in fact, making those connections with the other movements here in this country so people can see the interrelatedness of these issues. And it's all about the state. It's all about the colonial capitalist system that is the enemy of progress and the primary force undermining our ability to realize our collective human rights and the ultimate human right, which is the right to life.
Okay, I'd like to just announce we've collected $300 today. So. Very proud of that. I just want to respond quickly to this organizational question because the actions we've caught, again, Cindy Sheehan had her own demonstration. There were two others in Washington in the fall. We called one in spring the United National Anti-War Coalition, but it didn't come out of a national conference with other forces. And the way we did it in the 60s was to call an annual conference, anti-war conference, that would set dates that everybody knew about 6 months ahead of time, okay? And everybody was in on it and they were on the endorsers list. That's the way you start to build the unity. And as I said, we have to break down these divisions. But the role of the of a conference where people begin to work with each other and collaborate with each other and learn to trust each other is key. And you hash out all your differences there. But again, if you have differences, let them bring their own signs and slogans. We're uniting on whatever we can unite on. If it's stop endless war, that's enough to get people in the streets. The last thing I want to say is I think this particular anti-war movement on every level has given up one of our biggest weapons, and that's the slogan of support our troops, bring them home now. A lot of people, I've heard objections. I don't go for them. I don't think they're right. They took our slogan. The military took our slogan, support the troops, because they knew what a wedge that was in the American people to say the anti-war movement is the one that supports these poor working class GIs who are getting screwed, PTSD. We have to advance, start talking about the suicides. We're the ones that defend those guys, not them. And we have to take that slogan back.
I would like to add a couple of comments here. I think we're dealing with two levels to strengthen the peace movement. One is unity among ourselves, the peace movement, within the peace movement. The other is appealing to the public. And I think that should also be a focus of a very conscious effort to see what language, what issues would attract the public into the peace movement, anti-war movement. One thing we should recognize from the past, the public usually got involved when bodies started to come back. But the nature of wars, US wars and modern wars are changing. Many of them are fought by drones, remote control from bases here in the United States. Thousands are killed there, but nobody comes back. And that is not going to be an effective way of appealing to it. I think there's two other ways that we should also emphasize. One was the economic side, because every dollar spent on the military is sacrificing somebody's life here. We have to really bring to the public their life sacrifices that are results of this redirection of the U.S. funds into armament. Okay, this budget that we talked about is almost 67% right now. And we kind of miss every time they give you the Pentagon budget, nuclear weapons are under the Department of Energy.
That's right.
You have to bring that part in too, mm-hmm. and plus other things. It adds up to about close to $1 trillion now.
Yeah.
67%. These are the things that we have to show to the people. We have to also make sure in this electoral process, the issue of war is put on the agenda. Everybody is trying to hide it right now. Nobody mentions it. We have to really bring it to people's attention and make war and peace an issue of this electoral process cycle. Secondly, I think the environment would work the same way because a lot of young people are involved in that. And if we can also show the link between the wars and the Pentagon and all the research they're doing for destruction and the environment and the fossil fuel that is being used. You know, I was presenting at one workshop a long time ago, and I found out that any of these tanks that the military is using to run through Middle East, they burn 8 gallons per mile, not 8 miles per gallon, 8 gallons per mile. And you dispatch 100 of them from Kuwait to Baghdad, you can see how much fuel is being spent. So we have to bring all these to people's attention. And the environmentalists, I'm sure, if we can link it, they're going to be attracted to the anti-war movement also. So we have to focus on those things rather than dead bodies and stuff like that. No longer is as effective. It's not going to happen.
Okay, we're really over already, but I'm going to take the, I saw four hands before you, that's all I'm going to take. One, two, three, four, okay? Keep it very short.
She first.
Awesome.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. In answer to bringing our troops home, the reason why the military is not saying bring them home is that the anti-military. In relationship, I'm going to talk about humanity. In relationship to every dollar that the Pentagon or the military spends, we could say we can make and support seven jobs in healthcare. I'm a nurse in 50 years. That statistic hasn't changed much in the last 30 years. We also having been in the field as a nurse and in an office for insurances and doctors and things like that. So much, and as a citizen, so many of our first responders, whether we're talking about firemen, police, anybody in the reserves, anybody in trauma helicopter relief, anybody who's a neurosurgeon, anybody who's a neurologist, anybody who's a nurse in any kind of thing can be in the service can be called back in. And so these people are not available to us. And that has a huge impact on us. So we can't support ourselves. It's all going to the military. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, who was next?
Hi. I just want to make another link between the war and the war economy and life. As John said, the money is a consequence of the military. It's not. Money funds the military. And where does that money come from? The banks from 2008, the two big to jail banks that wiped out the wealth of so many millions of Americans, they buy the debt from the U.S. Treasury. And that debt, we're now, our government, national government debt, $22 trillion, is a war debt. Mm-hmm. And those banks are supporting the money that's going into the budget. It's not the result of it. It's going in. So I just want to thank you for that.
Okay. Last two, quickly.
Okay. One is with regards to the Citizens Climate Lobby. How many of you know the Citizens Climate Lobby? Okay, I will ask you to go ahead and read their proposal because it exempts the military entirely from any of the climate issues. It's all supported primarily except for what they call it a bipartisan bill because it's one Republican, but all the rest of them are Democrats. So read up on that entire list, spread the word. I'm in New Mexico. Francis Boyle from Champaign, Illinois, who's going to work on the anti-nuclear, calling it a crime against humanity. We are anticipating starting nuclear warhead pit production in two locations in the United States. One is Los Alamos, which has got three state roads that go into it, which I think are critical because if you ever wanted to go and shut down a lab, those are state roads and it would go to state court and not federal court. So, and the other one is Savannah River in Georgia. So if we're looking at anything, there's that. And then the other item is it's 50 years. Starting in October is the moratorium to end the war. And October 15th of 1969, that's coming up rapidly, as well as next year we've got Kent State, Jackson State, and of course, what people don't even realize, we had 11 people bayoneted at the University of New Mexico, two critically, and fortunately they survived. But we have no memorial at our location and other locations probably throughout the country where bad things happened during that time period. It's a time period to go ahead and reawaken this one. Thank you.
Thank you. And last.
I had two quick things. One, housekeeping for party business to our comrade earlier. I would love to see us embrace something like Keybase where we can sign up for and we can get alerts on actions that are coming up from the party. I think that would be another way to try to engage people or something along those lines. Maybe we'll
like what?
I'm sorry. Keybase. Oh, you don't like that one?
Yeah.
We've had luck with it. I know XR is using it, and it's been successful.
Yeah.
The other thing to consider with framing everything, you got to be aware the military has been spending over $50 million since 2008 in video game industry.
Yep.
Yeah.
With the war games, and even things like that come across as lighthearted, like Fortnite, stuff like that.
Yep.
Have those conversations with your kids and or relatives.
Yep. Okay, well, thank you everybody for being here and our speaker. Thank you. And don't forget to get these, and we have enough for everybody and even a few more.
Can I have one?
We have a petition circulating downstairs, calling on all candidates to take certain specific positions on issues of war and militarism. Please check it out.
Guys, if you send me the list of
I guess my feeling is that everything Green Party is sort of like.